You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Fairhead. Coming up, meal kit services offer recipes and ingredients to prepare quality food at home delivered to your door. They've been big during the pandemic. We'll get advice on what to know before you subscribe. Now, President Biden has a variety of foreign policy challenges waiting for him as he takes office, working on economic issues with China, building up strained NATO alliances, and dealing with Russia. It's one of the United States' most complicated relationships. Russia's invasion of Crimea tested the Obama administration. Its campaign hacking and disinformation efforts on social media were investigated throughout President Trump's time in office. And now a large-scale cyber attack has infiltrated U.S. government agencies and businesses. Most experts and officials point the finger at Russia on that one, too. We're checking in now with an expert on U.S.-Russia relations about where things stand now and what we might expect from a Biden administration. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What kind of tone do you want to see President Biden strike toward Vladimir Putin and Russia? Should the U.S. move to hold Russia accountable for the big cyber attack? What issues are you worried about when it comes to U.S.-Russian relationships? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Lowell Barrington is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University and an expert on post-communist politics. Lowell, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be back.
Well, what would you characterize our current relationship, the U.S.-Russia relationship, as right now as we switch from one White House to another?
Well, it's interesting because if we think about the last 4 years, that question would have really depended on what side you're asking the question from. From Russia's side, it had been a very good 4 years, with the exception of some of the sanctions that had either been in place previously or been kind of forced on the Trump administration by Congress. But other than that, Russia really did get most of what it wanted from U.S. foreign policy on a number of fronts. So I think the Biden administration inherits this situation where Russia has really benefited significantly from a lot of our decisions at the expense of, they would argue, and I would too, our own national security interests. So we inherit a situation where there are a lot of immediate challenges, which would include the cyber attack you mentioned, Alexei Navalny's fate, who's returned back to Russia and was promptly arrested at the airport. There's sort of some immediate things. There's relatively pressing things, and then there's also longer-term things for us to worry about.
What are some of the things you saw in the last 4 years under the Trump administration that might have helped Russia more than they helped the United States?
Well, I think just the tone in a lot of ways. President Trump treated Putin as a partner who could be believed over our own intelligence community in a lot of ways, and certainly over our longtime allies. I was thinking today about the press conference between Trump and Putin in Helsinki. Seems like decades ago now, but it was actually in, you know, July of 2018. And one of the lessons from that seemed to be that just the president's words really matter. And he continued to praise Putin throughout his presidency. And so there's kind of this tone, this rhetorical tone about how Russia could be trusted and Russia should not be a suspect when people think it's done bad things. And, you know, that occurred even when there was really clear evidence about what Russia had been doing. You mentioned all the way back to the, you know, election interference in 2016 to the recent cyber attacks. Throughout that whole period, Russia has been taking steps to kind of undermine our country's stability and security. And then I think there were some specific things. I mean, the sharing of classified information in the Oval Office, you know, with the Russian foreign minister and ambassador to the U.S., the undermining of NATO repeatedly in calls for NATO to be, you know, reformed and funded differently and things from President Trump, the calling for Russia to get back into the G7 when they were kicked out, withdrawing from Syria. I mean, there's sort of a number of things along the last few years that really, in President Trump's mind, may have benefited the United States, but in Putin's mind, clearly were big wins for Russia.
We are talking about U.S.-Russian relations right now with Lowell Barrington from Marquette University as we transition from the Trump presidency to now the Biden presidency. What do you want to see from the Biden administration when it comes to working with or against Russia and Vladimir Putin? How about the NATO alliance and our allies, longtime allies in Western Europe? What questions do you have about the last 4 years or the next 4 years? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. a lot of President Biden's inaugural speech focused on domestic issues, but he did mention the need to rebuild alliances. What would it take to do that, especially when it comes to NATO?
Well, I think it's both a quick process in that there was a sigh of relief, I think, across lots of Western Europe today. But it will also take time. I mean, the damage and sort of lack of trust is not something that you just snap your fingers and fix right away. But I think it will get repaired. I think there's common interests in Western Europe and the U.S. to repair that relationship. The other thing I think I would say is that one of the things about the focus on domestic issues today in the speech and things like unity is that President Biden understands that foreign policy and domestic political events and things are really tied together. So one of the other things about Putin was he had really hoped to kind of undermine Western-style democracy, discredit and divide especially the United States. And by the way, I'll tell you, when the U.S. has been talked about in recent years on Russian news, you know, in Russia itself, for example, I mean, there's just a drumbeat about what a mess the United States is, right? So one of the things about healing and creating unity, it's not just rhetoric. It's also about our position in the world and how other countries see us or maybe could again see us as a model rather than as something that Putin has tried to point to us as, which is just, again, a kind of mess and an example of why democracy doesn't work.
Yeah, what's through Russian eyes and maybe elsewhere, the events of January 6th and the storming of the U.S. Capitol, what did you see Russians and others seeing in the United States in that moment?
I mean, I think they saw what we saw, and that is not a good thing. I mean, they clearly saw how fragile the democracy appeared to be. They saw really a complete lack of preparation for some sort of conflict, which, again, I think is not something we want to portray abroad, that a relatively disorganized, I don't want to say they were unorganized entirely, but a, you know, relatively disorganized group of people could essentially take over one of the, you know, major buildings in our government in a kind of, you know, temple to democracy in all sorts of ways and things, right? So I think that's one of the, just the visual was such a powerful message. But also, I would say one of the really important things that Congress did was kind of get back up and finish its business that night. I think that was also, you know, we focus on the negatives and we should of that event, but it was a really important moment, and I will give some of the Republicans a lot of credit here too, of getting ourselves back together and showing the world in that same building that we could sort of finish the day's business. And I think that was a important message as well.
You mentioned that part of Putin's strategy is to disrupt Western democracy. That's not just the United States. Where else do we see these kind of activities, the cyber influence, the supporting of, I guess, far-right populist movements in other countries?
Right. They've certainly worked on that in Western Europe. They've been, you know, really aggressive, including even things like the Brexit vote in the UK. Russia had a lot of cyber influence on trying to whip up people to support the Brexit vote. I think there are a lot of things that they've been doing in that way. It's also been something in Eastern Europe we've seen a lot. There's been a targeting of some of the NATO members in Eastern Europe to try to weaken their governments a bit, even some of their neighboring states like Estonia and Latvia, but also trying to get more support for some of the more nationalist leaders in Poland and Hungary and places like that as well. So they've really been mostly targeting Europe more than other parts of the world. But, you know, certainly, again, they see this as a multi-front war, both a literal cyber war, but also a kind of public relations war.
We're talking to Lowell Barrington, associate professor of political science at Marquette University, looking at the U.S.-Russia relationship and where it may go with the presidential transition. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from President Biden when it comes to Russia and dealing with Vladimir Putin? What do you think the U.S. should do in response to the recent massive cyber attack targeting government agencies and a number of businesses as well? Are there other areas of concern for you when it comes to Russia? A lot of domestic items on the table. Do you think that there should be a focus on foreign policy issues, including Russia and elsewhere? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Lowell Barrington, professor of political science at Marquette University, looking at where America's relationship with Russia stands, what lies ahead as President Biden takes office. You can join in if you'd like with your thoughts and your questions and what you think of how the Trump administration dealt with Russia, what you're hoping for from the Biden administration. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Well, I wanted to talk to you about personnel from the Secretary of State. When we have one, we have an interim one on down. We saw a lot of people, Russia hands, leave the administration or be reshuffled after the impeachment and things like that. Where do we stand with the people, the knowledge, the institutional knowledge to deal with issues like this?
Well, that's a great question, because the sort of middle and upper middle levels of the bureaucracy in a lot of ways have really been gutted of a lot of the people that had a lot of experience and expertise in these areas. But I think President Biden will work pretty effectively to bring a lot of new people into those positions, hopefully fairly quickly. And I think that starts with the people that he's nominated at the top. I mean, this is with the exception of Jake Sullivan, who's his national security advisor, who's quite young. I think he's in his 40s, although does have some experience as deputy chief of staff, I think, at State Department. Other than that, I mean, these are senior people with a lot of experience. And that starts with Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State nominee, who again is somebody who brings a lot of expertise and competence. I think the interesting one, the defense secretary pick, which, as you know, was a bit controversial because it's a retired four-star general who had to get the special waiver because of how recently he had been active in the military to be defense secretary, Lloyd Austin. But he's, again, someone who is really well respected in the military and more broadly in the security community as well. And I think that's an important sign, again, of the effort to kind of rebuild these institutions with people that the people below them will trust and respect. And I think that's an important step. And even people like Merrick Garland, again, as Attorney General, who I think will do a great job of getting the Justice Department back to being, what it should be, instead of at times being a bit of a particular kind of political tool for the administration. I think that's going to be a really important step and, a signal to the world as well as domestically.
Now, going back before the Trump administration, we had then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton with her reset button idea that didn't pan out so well. Before that, President George W. Bush saying he'd looked into Putin's soul and found a guy he could work with. Nobody's really figured this out, right? There are no easy answers when it comes to dealing with Russia.
No, that's a fair point. And I think, again, the reset worked actually for the first Obama term pretty well. It just went really south after that. I think we know more than we did. And I think once we can move beyond the sort of strange relationship that we had between a president and President Putin to get to a point, again, where we bring in the experts who study this, I think we have a better sense that you need both. You need to be able to negotiate with Russia. We have I mentioned the cyber attack and Alexei Navalny and things like that as kind of pressing needs. There's another really pressing topic, which is the New START treaty, which is set to expire in just a couple of weeks at this point in February. And, that's a really important treaty between Russia and the U.S., in part because both Russia and the U.S. have pulled out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. So this New START treaty is essentially the only remaining nuclear weapons treaty we have with Russia. And there's a way to do a five-year extension. I know they're going to work on that real hard from the start of the Biden administration. So there's kind of this, on the one hand, we need to do that. We need to negotiate. But the other side of it is you have to respond and you have to punish Russia more forcefully, both in our words but also the actions. And Russia is fairly vulnerable still economically. And I think they've, but the combination of the effects of COVID and the economic instability in Russia, which is partly still due to some of the sanctions we've had hanging on, but also the lower price of oil and things like that, have made them vulnerable to pressure if we were willing to do that. So I think that's going to be the goal in a lot of ways for the Biden administration, is to figure out this carrot and stick approach where we need to work with them on things, but we also just can't let them do what they want without consequences.
Yeah, let's talk more about the nuclear weapons issue. I mean, I was of the generation that grew up with the day after and kind of the threat of nuclear war. you still have two well nuclear armed superpowers, the United States and Russia, out there, and you know it's not front and center all the time. Should we be watching that more closely?
I'm pretty confident they'll get something worked out. I think it's in Russia's interest not to have another arms race. You know, they can't afford that financially in the same way to have massive increases in expenditures for nuclear weapons either. I think there's some sense that it's in both countries' interest to get that worked out. Hopefully, again, that can happen by the deadline of the expiration of the New START treaty. But I think things will get worked out there. Your point's an interesting one, though, because there are a lot of things we don't pay attention to that I think could be kind of flashpoints. I mean, Ukraine's gotten a lot of attention, but, you know, we were really not part of the negotiations over Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine were really working with Germany and France on that. I would expect that the Biden administration would like to get involved in that a little more. And the other one's really interesting, and we thought about it a little bit, I guess, in the context of Syria, but it's the Eastern Mediterranean region is one that both NATO, including the U.S., and Russia have a kind of contest over, in the sense that it's our southern flank in a way in terms of NATO, but it's also the link in the Russian case from the Black Sea to the Indian Ocean, and they see it as a crucial part of their both economic and security interests. And it's one of the big reasons that they were so focused on Syria was to maintain good relations over ports, for example, in Syria and the Eastern Mediterranean. So, I mean, that's one, if you're thinking about what do we not talk enough about, that's a kind of sneaky one, I think, that we need to keep, you know, keep our eyes on a little bit, that there could be some actual, you know, potential confrontations in the Mediterranean there.
Talking to Lowell Barrington from Marquette University, looking at U.S.-Russian relations as we have a change of administrations in the White House. Lowell, you mentioned earlier the idea of consequences for bad behavior by the Russians, whether it's interference in other countries' elections or massive cyber attacks on the United States. But what kind of tools do we have to respond to those kind of things in a meaningful way?
I think the sanctions one is still really underutilized. I mean, we put sanctions on Russia a couple times during the Trump administration, but he was, again, the President Trump at that point was dragged a bit into those or forced at one point actually by Congress with veto-proof majorities in both houses to basically force some new sanctions on Russia. But again, Russia is vulnerable economically. I think sanctions can work. The other thing that we can do is, again, call out Russia more forcefully. I mean, it really matters to Putin how he's viewed in the world. And it was very helpful when they would do something if the president were to say, well, it might be them, but it might be other people. We don't really know. But the intelligence community did know, right? So I think changing the rhetoric is going to help. And then the third thing, again, is just, you know, when you display competence and fact-based approaches to policymaking and a commitment to democracy and a commitment to unity. And again, I'll go back to that. You know, we heard the word unity and united and things in the address today by President Biden, you know, repeatedly. But when you do those things, you take away a lot of the ammunition for people like Putin. It weakens his claim to have a kind of model that's better than the American model around the world. And I think one of the things, again, we need to do is just get our domestic house in order, and that will go at least part of the way to helping us push back against Russia.
One changing factor, you know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, you had basically one superpower in the world, the United States. Now we've got the rise of China, definitely as an economic power, rising military power. Does that change how we think about Russia?
Yeah, in a couple of ways. One of them, the New START Treaty I mentioned, one of the delays in getting that renegotiated was that we wanted China as part of it because we are concerned about the development of the nuclear weapons in China as well. So even the issue of something just like nuclear security, the China question is a big one in U.S.-Russian relations. We also are very concerned, though, about some of the connections developing and strengthening between Russia and China, that one of the things that's happened is that we have, and the argument might be, we've kind of driven China toward Russia a bit in the last few years. And so I think that that's one, again, just thinking about Russia is an important regional power, but a united Russia and China working together on security issues is a much bigger threat.
Let's bring on a caller. Harry is with us in Delavan. Harry, hello.
Hi. Yeah, the one thing I wanted to say is that once Biden was in there and he was sworn in, I had a huge feeling of relief you know, it just took a huge burden off my heart. So thank you.
Harry, why is that?
Because now the Russians ain't going to take us over. And we're not going to get bombed by the Russians. And we're not going to get into any stupid wars.
Harry, thanks for the call. I don't know that there was a major risk of being bombed by the Russians, but Harry feeling relieved and thinking that Biden will be a more reliable hand, I guess, in dealing with Russia, Lowell.
Yeah, and I think that's right. I think that's happening in the U.S. I talked to a friend today who actually said, is it strange that I feel so relieved today? And I said, no, that's a feeling a lot of people are having. And I think, again, it's also a feeling outside the United States. I think that it's as important to Western Europe and a lot of other parts of the world that we have kind of turned the page here, hopefully moving forward in, a focus on experience and competence and facts and things that, again, just makes generally for a much more stable government and stable foreign relations with the U.S. and other countries around the world.
Briefly, Lowell, over the last 4 years, we've seen in some cases Republicans in Congress take the lead on pushing for consequences for Russia. Do you see that as a place where a Democratic president and Republicans in Congress might find common ground?
That's a great question, because, yes, I think that is one where I think a lot of the Republicans in Congress felt sort of awkward and uneasy at times with the lack of verbal and actual sanction-like pushback from the Trump administration. So I think that's definitely, as President Biden does look for places where we can bring Republicans and Democrats together, I think being stronger against countries around the world that are pushing an anti-democratic model and trying to undermine our system, I think that would be a great place to start.
We'll leave it there, Lowell. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob.
Lowell Barrington is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. He talked with us about what the presidential transition could mean for relations between the U.S. and Russia. Coming up, meal kit delivery services have increased in popularity in the last few years. We'll get details on what to look for before you sign up. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin National Guard representative updates us on the Guard's role in distributing coronavirus vaccine in the state, including with new mobile vaccination centers. Now, meal kits are a curated package of ingredients that aim to give you the tools you need to cook delicious meals at home. They often come delivered to your door. During a pandemic, when many are opting to eat in and maybe trying new things in the kitchen, we're going to get some advice on what to look for when picking out a meal kit delivery service that suits you. Jim Temmer is the president and CEO of the Better Business Bureau of Wisconsin. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
Well, the Bureau put out a release on meal kits and what to watch out for. I assume you did that because these things are getting pretty popular these days. Is that right?
That's right. And, you know, you mentioned the pandemic. So not only do you have people staying at home, it's great to support our local restaurants, you know, and they need help all they can. But people are learning to stay at home, have a home-cooked meal, and to learn. I mean, cooking is actually a fun and wonderful hobby. And when you make it easy for people, they're more apt to do it.
But one size might not fit all. Give us the lay of the land. What's kind of the standard for meal kits and what they come with?
Well, the standard simply is food. And after that, it's what you're looking for. Some people want as easy as possible. So they want everything kind of delivered, sauces made, things chopped up. Just, I'm going to mix it, I'm going to cook it, and it's done. Other people really do want to have some of the learning and home cooking experience, so they'll just give you the raw ingredients, and then you have to mix and make and produce it on your own. And it's really what you want to do. You know, there's differences in food quality. Obviously, budget is something to look at. People might not always want to go with the cheapest option because they want some better ingredients. So it's a time factor, how much time you want to put into it, how much money you want to put into it. But, you know, when people are delivering product right to your door and you don't have to go out and risk anything going to a grocery store, although, again, we support our local grocers as much as we can, it's really a good option for people. And more young people are taking advantage of this as well.
Before we dig in more into the specifics, one thing I wonder anytime I set up a subscription to something, whether it's a website, a newspaper, or a meal kit, or whatever, something where things are being deducted from a bank account or credit card or whatever, how easy is it to get out of these when we're doing anything like that, whether it's a meal service or something else? How can we protect ourselves from the infinite recurring charge if we decide we want to get out later?
Well, you're a wise man in raising that question, Rob. I'll tell you, online, call them free trial offer scams, especially in the new year, are all over the place. Weight loss pills, skincare, people have a lot of New Year's resolutions and they try and fulfill. And you can go online and find links to what look like news stories that aren't. Fake celebrity endorsements are out there. And the devil is in the details. You'll fill in your name and information. And way, way down at the bottom, after a lot of blank spot, they may have their terms and conditions. And if it isn't returned in 30 days, you have to pay the full price of it. And you might not get it till day 28. So like any of them, some of those are just out and out scams. A lot of these companies, you just want to do your homework. Like if you're purchasing anything, check and see with their customer service, because maybe something comes and the food isn't in good shape. You know, maybe something is bruised beyond repair, or heaven forbid, rotten. Or you didn't get something. You want to know that you can call a number, talk to somebody, and get a refund. And if you have any problems with anything you're doing online with a subscription, the first place you go is your credit card. And you ask them to remove these charges, to end payments to that company because they broke the contract. Always use a credit card when you're going online. They have a lot more protections for you than any type of other payment.
Including debit cards? Is there a significant difference, credit versus debit card, for those kind of payments?
Yeah, some debit cards have some protections, but across the board, most credit cards have built-in protections where if there are unauthorized charges or you buy something and it never shows up, you may only have like a $50 fee that you're open to, or you might not even have to pay anything. Maybe that's why the interest rates are so high on credit cards, but it is a protection that's available from them.
Talking to Jim Temer, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau of Wisconsin, looking at meal kits. There are local and national ones out there. They're very popular. He's talking about good ways to shop to make sure you get what you want, what you need, and can cancel it if you want to get out. Jim, you're starting to get into some of the questions of, like, you know, if somebody goes to shop, the kind of questions they should ask. What other kind of things should we watch for if we decide, okay, maybe we want to dip our toes in the meal kit game? Well, that sounds kind of gross. Forget the toe. But we want to try meal kits. What are some of the things we should think about as we compare and contrast one to another?
Well, you know, people may have good expectations going in. They think they want to learn things. I don't know how many people know the difference between searing and braising or roasting and pan roasting. You can learn all of these things, but if you get a little too deep, they just deliver ingredients to you and they say, braise something at 500. You may not even know what that means. And learning might be part of what you're looking for, but that's great. But if you aren't looking for that much learning and you really are kind of a novice in the kitchen, you might want to go with one of the meal preps that's more complete.
I've been doing one of these, a local one. It's worked out. My only gripe is they underestimate how long it takes to cook a potato. I'm not going to make a complaint about that. I can add cooking time, no problem. But suppose somebody gets into one of these things, they have a dispute with the company. Can they reach out to a group like the Better Business Bureau for help, or to report more serious problems than that?
Well, you bet you can. First of all, I mean, we're a place for reviews. We vet all of our reviews. We give businesses an opportunity to respond to those reviews and complaints. Of course, we've been doing for over 100 years. So if that company is based in Wisconsin, we will handle that. If it's a national company that's based in another state, a BBB station there can help you out. And we're really a neutral third party between buyers and sellers. And our mission is to increase trust in the marketplace. So we're looking for involved, interested consumers who make wise choices. That's why we're talking about this today. And we also want to try and create ethical, honest businesses.
Before I let you go, Jim, I want to switch gears radically here. I've seen some signs, including, I think, from your organization, that there are COVID-19 vaccine scams out there. Wow. Who would do that? But people do. What are you seeing?
From the beginning of this pandemic, the scammers have been operating in overtime. And you can see things on social media about, you know, sign up here to reserve your spot in line, or even people claiming to sell vaccines. And it's just ridiculous. You know, don't fall for any of this stuff. go to a trusted news source like we're listening to right now here in Wisconsin Public Radio, or any of your local government agencies can help you out. And there are fake, you know, CDC websites out there. Remember, an actual government website will always end in .gov. So if they're claiming to be someone they aren't, that's a good way to start.
Jim, thanks as always for joining us today.
You bet. My pleasure, Rob.
Jim Temer is the president and CEO of the Better Business Bureau of Wisconsin. He shared tips and advice on choosing a meal kit delivery service and to make sure you get what you're paying for. Time now for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a why Wisconsin question about political opposites a week as we mark the presidential inauguration.
In 1952, Leonard Schmidt ran against controversial Senator Joseph McCarthy on the Republican ticket in Wisconsin and lost. We recently received a Wisconsin question from a listener who wanted to know more about Schmidt. Liz Domes-Harder brings us the story of a man who rebuked the division and chaos that defined McCarthyism.
In 1952, Senator Joseph McCarthy was already 2 years into his crusade against communism, making unsubstantiated claims that communists and spies were infiltrating the U.S. government and Hollywood. Then, Leonard Schmidt, an attorney from Merrill, Wisconsin, entered his political sphere.
He was a former progressive and a longtime thorn in the side of the conservative Republicans.
That's Larry Tye, an author who's written about McCarthy. Schmidt described his challenger for the U.S. Senate as a liar, a hoax, a demagogue. 70 years later, that word, demagogue, would show up again as the title of Tye's latest book, detailing the life of McCarthy.
So at a moment of great fear in America, Joe McCarthy was a demagogue who capitalized on that fear with lots of simplistic and false promises.
Schmidt was emphatic in his fight for the little fellow. His passion for justice and integrity, along with a nudge from his friend who ran the Capital Times newspaper, convinced Schmidt to run for office. He lost the primary to McCarthy overwhelmingly. But in a time of division, dishonesty, and political corruption, Schmidt was a disciple of decency. His calls for fairness and moral treatment of others would follow him far out of the political spotlight. Nancy Meyer knew Schmidt. She's 85 years old now and lives in Merrill. She first met Schmidt in 1969. He was still a titan of local politics.
I could have been intimidated, but he had a very gracious way about him. I mean, he was a trial lawyer. I'm sure he knew how to handle people.
She was invited to a meeting with him. She had just been named chairperson of the Democratic Party of Lincoln County, where Merrill is located. Lincoln County has a long history of voting red.
At any rate, he congratulated me on winning, if that's what you want to call it, being chairman of the Democratic Party.
She was the first woman to do so. Schmidt was conscious that some might not have approved of a woman in that role.
He felt that because I was a woman and leading a county political party, I might run into some difficulties, resistance, people really not accepting of it. He told me that if I needed any kind of support or advice, that I was always welcome to contact him.
Schmidt believed in political civility. He encouraged engagement, telling young attorneys in his office to get involved in politics, no matter the side. He was progressive, and he was Republican through and through. He served as delegate to the Republican National Convention in 1936 and as district attorney in Lincoln County. He supported Republicans in their political careers throughout his life. McCarthy was a Republican, too, and he ran for district attorney. In fact, both men were Roman Catholic. Both were military men. But McCarthy was ruthless.
When they're attacked, bullies like that aim wrecking balls at their assailants.
For his campaign against McCarthy, Schmidt received hundreds of letters of hate mail. He was called Benedict Arnold and a communist. He forged ahead anyway.
He was very unassuming. Boy, he must have been one determined fellow.
A living example that putting people above party, even in chaos, is a legacy that lives on.
WPR's Liz Domes-Harder brought us that story on Leonard Schmidt, who ran against Joseph McCarthy.
She answered a listener question that came through our Wisconsin project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, Wisconsin's National Guard is working on mobile vaccination stations. We'll find out how it works, where it's happening, and how it fits into the wider efforts against COVID-19 in the state. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Join us tonight at 6 for NPR special coverage of the White House News Conference with incoming Press Secretary Jen Psaki. It's the first daily briefing with reporters on the new Biden-Harris administration's agenda. Now, there's a new addition to Wisconsin's COVID-19 vaccine distribution plan, mobile vaccination units. These teams of 12 to 15 people will help register people to get vaccinated, administer the vaccines, and make sure people don't have allergic reactions. Yesterday, 9 teams were dispatched around the state, the goal to give 70 to 140 vaccinations a day. Part of the goal here is to make the COVID-19 vaccine more accessible. Department of Health Services Secretary-designee Andrea Palm said, quote, "We have seen how differences in opportunity, resources, and access to quality health care have exacerbated this public health crisis. That's why this program is an especially critical tool in Wisconsin's vaccination rollout." The mobile vaccination teams will be staffed by National Guard members and volunteer nursing and pharmacy students. Major Joe Trovato is a spokesperson for the Wisconsin Department of Military Affairs. Major Trovato, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's always good to be here.
Well, these units just rolled out, I think, yesterday. How's it going so far?
Yeah, it got off to a great start yesterday. We did our first mobile vaccination team in Greendale, Wisconsin, down in Milwaukee County. And by and large, it was a big success. Working closely with the local health department there, they did about a little more than 60 vaccines at that site, and that was exactly what they were expecting for that first day. And we have a few more planned for the rest of this week as well.
Can you talk about the role the National Guard is playing in this?
Sure. So we absolutely serve in a support role in anything that we do. So we're not the lead on any of this. We're very much in a support role and working closely with the Department of Health Services and local health departments as well. And in this case, we have of these vaccination teams, National Guard members make up about 4 members of the teams. So we're largely performing some of the administrative functions. So we're going to help with some of the registration and check-in, the education piece. You know, we're going to give you some background information on the vaccine itself and make sure that you understand, what the vaccine is and what you'd be receiving at the station. And then we're also going to help with the monitoring afterwards for allergic reaction. But it's actually UW system health and pharmacy students that would be physically administering the actual vaccine.
And there are places in Wisconsin, I know, where access to healthcare centers can be few and far between. Do you see, are your units scheduled to be in maybe more rural parts of the state as this rolls along?
Well, right now we've got, at least this week, for example, we had the first one yesterday in Greendale, and then we have another one that was in Eau Claire, and then tomorrow will be in Sauk County as well, assisting the health department there. So as we get more requests for assistance from around the state and from health departments around the state, I do expect that that we'll be really in all sorts of communities, not just rural, but in other communities and places where maybe there aren't the resources in place to be able to offer an effective program immediately.
Talking to Major Joe Trovato, spokesperson for the Wisconsin Department of Military Affairs, talking about the National Guard's role in new mobile vaccination units. And Major Trovato, last time we talked about how the Wisconsin National Guard has been a real Swiss Army knife this last year, doing so many different things. Can you talk about some of the other things that the pandemic itself has brought the National Guard out to a variety of roles around the state?
Well, of course, yeah, we really have taken on a lot of different roles throughout Wisconsin since the pandemic began. We've been, probably the most visual part that most people are familiar with is the COVID-19 testing that's going on statewide. We've tested in pretty much every corner of the state at this point, nearly every county. I believe we've at least had some testing at some point. And we've now collected well over 1 million COVID-19 tests since the pandemic began. And that's really since May when we started doing widespread community-based testing. And that's just one of the missions, too. I mean, we've assisted also with staffing a warehouse that in the early days of the pandemic was assisting with critical shipments of PPE that were coming into the state. And we're also assisting, too, right now with stockpile management or inventory management of the vaccines that are getting shipped into the state. So it's really run the gambit. We've had a lot of different roles, and really we've played a pretty critical role in the overall pandemic response here in Wisconsin.
Getting away from the pandemic, the National Guard also played a role in the big news of the day, the inauguration at the state capitol. Some Wisconsin National Guard troops deployed to help secure the nation's capital. Can you talk about that?
Yes, we have more than 550 Wisconsin National Guard members who are out in Washington, D.C. They deployed there over the weekend alongside about 25,000 other National Guard troops from every state and territory across the nation to assist with, you know, safety and security in the National Capital Region. And, by and large, our troops have performed extremely well. We've asked a lot of them this year, and they've just continued to answer the call in such a professional way time and time again. But we're proud of them. They played a big role out there in D.C.
It's been a weird year in so many years. Are you hopeful that, you know, things might be a little quieter in the days to come and you can maybe not be calling on the National Guard to be doing so many different things in the next handful of months?
I think we're all hoping that things quiet down a little bit, certainly. But, this is who we are. It's what we do. We wear this uniform because we want to serve our state and our communities and our nation. This is very much our core mission. Pandemic response might be something that's new for us, or, you know, certainly civil unrest responses or security missions are not something that we do every single day by any means. But it is why we wear the uniform, because we want to be there for our communities when they need us. And, you know, I really just can't say it enough that we have asked so much of our citizen soldiers and airmen who have just answered the call time and time again. We've had pretty much our entire force has mobilized in some capacity, whether that's been for a federal overseas deployment to Iraq or Afghanistan or the Middle East, or now here in Wisconsin, the pandemic response, assisting with the state's elections, California wildfire response that we were a part of earlier this year, or now here with the inauguration and security missions. And we've just truly asked so much of our troops, their employers, their families, and they've just done so well and been so professional throughout all of it.
Major Trevato, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Major Joe Trevato is a spokesperson for the Wisconsin Department of Military Affairs. He joined us for a look at the state National Guard's role in new mobile vaccination stations and, as you just heard, their role in a lot of other stuff, too, over this last year, even up today in the nation's capital. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, a new report looks at the state of mental health for kids here in Wisconsin. The director of the state's Office on Children's Mental Health joins the show for a look at the findings and what the state needs to do to boost the well-being of children. That's tomorrow morning at 8 on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk about today's inauguration with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief. And by the way, tune in today at 6 for live NPR coverage of the inaugural press conference from the new Biden-Harris administration. There'll be a focus on the top priorities on day one and week one of the Biden administration. That's today at 6 here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.